Okay. So we are, this is our next to last class, but we're still in the middle of the book. And that's kind of intentional. If you have been reading ahead, you'll probably have noticed that that chapters 8 through 10 is a lot of like procedure and recording of the decree and things like that. It recounts the same story of the Jews defending themselves at least twice, maybe three times, if you include the second day. So we'll talk about all that next time, but we're not going to spend as much time on that as we have on some other things that are a little bit more character related. On that note, since we're talking about Haman's downfall today, I just wanted to make one last observation from chapter 5, at the end of the chapter where Haman goes home from the banquet. He's really happy. He's on top of the world. Notice that nothing real has happened to him. He hasn't gained any more power. He hasn't gotten any more money. He hasn't gotten any more sons. These are all things that he boasts about to his wife and his friends. And yet he feels like he's accomplished something, like he's, you know, gone up in the world because the queen invited only me and the king to come and dine with her. And yet, when Mordecai doesn't bow down to him in the gate, his whole world falls apart. And he goes home and he says, it doesn't mean anything to me that I have all these things when Haman won't bow down to me. We've been kind of drawing applications from Esther and Mordecai in particular because they are the characters who, I'm arguing, are being transformed over the course of the book. But it might be worth making one application from Haman's life here, and that is, considering all of the blessings that each of us has, which are different for each of us, of course, but considering all of the blessings in your life, what are the things that make you feel like none of that means anything? You know, like when this happens, I can't remember the blessings that I have. Maybe it's a temptation, maybe it's somebody that disrespects you, like has happened here to Haman. But I think it would be useful for us to identify in our own lives the thing or things that sort of feel, at least, like they invalidate all of the blessings that God has given us. And I think if we could do that, it would eliminate some of the opportunities for stumbling that life presents us. If we know in advance, when this happens, I'm going to feel really discouraged. I'm going to feel like nothing matters anymore. And if we know what that is in advance, we can take steps to not fall into the trap that Haman falls into, which is, he's already got a plan in place to eliminate all the Jews, including Mordecai, but that's not enough for him. He's got to go after this one guy in particular. And as we'll see today, that desire to kill Mordecai turns out to be the beginning of his undoing. Well, part of his undoing. Maybe the beginning of his undoing was trying to fight against the Jews, but that's kind of the question that the book is asking. So anyway, I thought that was an application worth making from Haman's life. Any other thoughts on the end of chapter 5? Anything that stood out to you from Haman's little pity party? Okay. So we only have one objective for today. It's kind of a big one, so maybe that's why there's only one. It's just to be able to list at least three clear instances of providence in Esther 6. We've been talking about providence. We're going to see it clearly in action in this chapter, and I hope that as we go through, we'll be able to identify more than three, but several instances of providence in Esther 6. There are some in Esther 7 as well, of course, but chapter 6, being the heart of the book, I think it's important for us to identify God at work, even though he's not named. So here's our outline of Esther. We've been looking at this every time. Remember, it's organized chiastically, centered around this point, which we're going to look at today, the point where Haman's fortunes turn, where everything's going great for him up to chapter 5. He's on top of the world, except for that one guy who won't bow down to him. But in chapter 6, he experiences a major reversal, and things start to slide uncontrollably downhill from there. And they slide out downhill very quickly, basically within the course of the next chapter. So it's important. This chapter is important for that reason. I'll also just say, on the other hand, this is not a difficult chapter. There's not a lot of like complex textual questions or, you know, difficult applications or anything like that, except for maybe this question about providence. Other than that, it's fairly straightforward, and I hope that we'll be able to, you know, kind of not get distracted by all the details, some of which I'll explain, but focus on some of the bigger picture things that are going on as far as how the book is working. So I want to start by reading chapter 6, verses 1 through 9. We're going to read these first, and then I'm going to ask you this question, but I'll leave it up here so you can see it while we're reading. But I want you to consider the whole chapter, but for another different reason, I want us to read just the first 9 verses, so I can get somebody to read chapter 6, verses 1 through 9.
On that night, the king could not sleep. He gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, and two had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man who the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on a horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'"
Okay, so turn to the person next to you, working groups, if that's better, and just kind of look through these verses we've just read and the rest of chapter 6, verses 10 through 14, and just make a list of things that you think are or probably are God's providence at work. You don't have to explain them, I just want a list of events. I'll give you about a minute to work on that. Okay, what did you come up with?
Providence looks like coincidence a lot of times, right?
I think so, yeah.
I think it's coincidental. The fact that he couldn't sleep, right? The fact that the book available happened to be the book that was about Mordecai. I guess he missed the page, but it's just what Mordecai did. All those kinds of things pointed out as being providential.
Yeah, I think those are two very good examples. And what else?
The fact that Haman happens to be in the court,
yeah.
Right? That right as they're reading about Mordecai and he happens to be there and just like right at the right time.
Yeah, what else? These are good. I think there are more.
Well, we said like how the king phrases the question. Like,
yeah.
He never says Mordecai. He just says who.
And Haman never asks.
Yeah.
Of course, he knows who the king's talking about, so he doesn't have to ask.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But,
yeah. Good. Anything else? Yes.
And just like proximity, because I mean, you can't sleep lots of nights. But the fact that this is just like right after the banquet,
yeah.
He was on cloud 9.
Yeah.
You know, helps him. Give the wrong answer.
You could say that he maybe had too much to drink, but I don't think that's possible.
Yeah.
For Ahasuerus. Good. Anything else?
I think the fact that Haman is coming in there to talk about Mordecai and the king summons him to talk about Mordecai, but the way they're talking about Mordecai is vastly different.
Yeah. It's like one commentator described the conversation they have as like an Abbott and Costello routine. That may not mean anything to some of you, but where they're both having a conversation and we know what they're both saying, but they don't know what each other are talking about, but they think they're having a good conversation. Chapter 6 is maybe one of the funniest chapters in the whole Bible. And that conversation is the irony and the satirical elements of it, I think, are just wonderful. Anything else? So I want to talk about the some of these things, kind of work through the chapter and point out these instances and maybe explore some of them a little bit. So we pointed out Ahasuerus couldn't sleep. People proposed various kind of physical reasons for that. And we know that God works in the physical, using physical things in the world to accomplish his purpose. Some have proposed that he's worried about what Esther's going to ask. She's kind of put him off twice, right, building this tension. And you could see how he might be kind of, this must be a big deal, possible. Maybe he's concerned by the fact that Esther has invited Haman again to the second feast. We talked a little bit last time about how she could be trying to sort of subtly insinuate that, like, she really likes Haman a lot, which might have implications for conspiracy. And we're going to see that kind of fleshed out a little bit today, but again, we don't know. It could just be the direct action of God. It is possible that God just said, you're not going to sleep tonight. But, I mean, the text doesn't say. Yes?
I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I heard a preacher say one time that this is also the night that Haman's building the gallows. So
it is.
It might be a little loud, and that's why Ahasuerus can't sleep again.
It could be.
To me, but I don't know if it's accurate.
It could be, and there is some evidence that the gallows is very close by. On the other hand, later in the chapter, or in chapter 7, we're going to see that the king maybe doesn't know that the gallows are there. And if you remember from that, I don't have it with me today, but the plan that I showed of the palace, like, there's a pretty long way between the palace and the places where Haman would have been most likely to live. So it's possible, but I think it's a little bit unlikely. Also, because I think if someone outside the king's palace had been making noise and disturbing him, they would have died. Right? That's not the kind of thing he would have gone, okay, well, I'm just going to have to turn my music up louder. You know, that's not the world that he lived in. Yes?
There's plenty of evidence around the book that Xerxes is most likely an alcoholic. And funny thing about alcohol, it makes you feel sleepy, but it doesn't actually help you sleep.
Right.
So that might have also been contributing back to the life easily.
Yeah. Yeah. It's possible. Like I said, we don't really know why, and I think my view is that the writer of the book intentionally omits the reason, whatever the reason is. It may have a natural explanation, but I think the writer intentionally omits it so that we see that God is working, even if he's not directly, you know, keeping his eyelids open. We're intended to see that this is providential. It is God at work in the story. And so his Ahasuerus' solution is to have the Chronicles read to him. And again, this is one of those, you know, kind of comic elements in the story, I think. It could be that he just wants to hear a story where he's the hero, which his Chronicles would be, which is funny in one way. It could be, if he's worried about the possible conspiracy against him, that he wants to remember, wait, what did we do last time? And so he maybe then intentionally calls for, like, go find me the last time somebody tried to kill me and read me that story. And that would be the story of the time where Mordecai rescued him. That's possible. It could just be satire in the sense that, you know, I think we've all turned on music or an audio sermon or audio book or something to try to fall asleep. But maybe more applicably, how many of us have ever struggled to stay awake during a sermon in church? Right? So maybe the king's just hoping to be bored to sleep by his own life. And that's the satire, right? That he's hoping to be sort of lulled off to sleep by this reading, but it's a reading about him. It's about things he did and that happened in his kingdom, and it's so boring that it's going to put him to sleep. I don't know. There's many ways to read that, but the king doesn't look real great in any of them, which I think is part of the point. So another thing we observed was that they read this chronicle about Mordecai saving him. At this point in the story, this chronicle, which was, of course, written back in chapter 2, or 3, I've forgotten, 2, comes back to the surface, and now we have two Persian documents about Mordecai in conflict with one another. There's Haman's document, which is created because of Mordecai's actions that says all the Jews, including Mordecai, will be killed. And there's another document, which is the Chronicles of the Court, that says Mordecai's a really great guy and needs to be rewarded, and, by the way, has not been rewarded. These two documents are now in conflict. And some commentators have proposed that since Mordecai's name is included in the Chronicle, and also not included specifically in Haman's decree, that there's this kind of should raise our hopes as readers to say that the Jews will still be spared, because it isn't just somebody saved the king's life, it's Mordecai, the Jew, and the king knows he is a Jew because that's how he describes him later in the chapter, saved the king's life. So Mordecai's name being recorded potentially is supposed to make us go, oh, okay. Everything's going to... it's possible that things will work out okay. As he reads, he discovers that nothing has been done to reward Mordecai. And that's important. We talked a little bit about how Persian kings would honor those who helped them. But failing to reward a benefactor would be a source of great shame for the king. To not honor a person who had helped you would have been seen as a sign of weakness, and maybe even of dishonoring the gods or something like that by not rewarding a benefactor. So fortunately, or we would say providentially, the king discovers this oversight all by himself. It's like the only thing he discovers by himself in the whole book, right? That he didn't reward Mordecai. So now he can fix the problem without looking incompetent, because he discovered it, he can go and fix it, you know, everything will work out all right. But again, I think we're supposed to see God's providence in that the king feels compelled to honor Mordecai and has not, that's also providential, and discovers it himself so that he can kind of do it quickly, get it done with, and not have to be worried about being embarrassed by his oversight. And so doing it quickly means that's the first thing he's going to take care of in the morning. And so we've noted that Haman comes into the court, but once again, notice that the king needs help making a decision. Right? He can't do this on his own. He says, "Who's out in the courtyard?" It fits with this characterization that we've seen of him as kind of inept and clueless. But again, providentially, it provides the setup for the beginning of these reversals in Haman's fortunes. Because Haman has come to the court first thing in the morning, just like his wife told him to do, against the law. Remember, wives aren't supposed to give orders to their husbands from chapter 1, but Zeresh gives Haman lots of orders and he obeys all of them. So he comes to the court first thing in the morning to ask if he can kill Mordecai. And it does seem to be first thing in the morning, because otherwise there would have been more people in the court instead of just Haman. But it's possible that just like the king hasn't slept, Haman also hasn't slept because he's been up all night building. So he would have... Again, there's this kind of dramatic tension that underlies the text. It doesn't really focus on this, but remember, you can't just go into the king unsummoned. So Haman is, you can almost picture him, however long he had been there, pacing up and down in the courtyard, hoping that someone will notice him and tell the king, oh, Haman's out here, and you know, you can, and then the king would summon him in, and then, okay, good, I can make my request. But without that summons, he can't go into the king. So the tension is building in his mind, as well as in our minds, as we read. And so the king asks Haman to come in and give him advice, which is totally normal. That's how the king operates. But remember, as I've said, that each of the two people who are talking here thinks they're talking about something else, or talking about something different than the other one does. And they each have an opposite agenda. The king wants to honor Mordecai. Haman wants to kill Mordecai. And they're so focused on what they want to do that they basically forget how to have a normal conversation. Right? You don't normally start talking about someone to someone else without first identifying them. Right? You say, hey, I've noticed that we forgot to honor Mordecai. We need to fix that. The king doesn't do that. And Haman doesn't think to ask either, because he's so focused on what he wants to accomplish. Okay, yeah, honor, whatever. We'll get that out of the way. Look, I got an important question to ask. And it's only when he starts to realize that this is like a really important honor and it might be about him that he actually starts paying attention. But by then it's too late to ask who they're talking about. He just has to sort of assume, based on his ego, that they're talking about him. But I want us to see that Mordecai's life, and consequently then his and Esther's plan to save the Jews, hangs on the outcome of this interview. If Haman, you know, wins this conversation, then there's really not a lot of hope for the Esther and Mordecai's plan. I mean, their plan was always going to have to involve writing a new decree, and Esther's not really qualified to write that. She needs somebody like Mordecai, who apparently is familiar enough with the court etiquette and procedure to be able to do something like that. Because clearly the king's not going to write his own laws. He hasn't done that yet. So this is really critical. But the other thing that we need to see as we're thinking about God's providence is that Esther and Mordecai are not in this chapter. They don't know about this conversation. And even if they did know about it, which I don't think they did, they couldn't stop it because they can't just walk into the king unannounced. Esther got away with it once, but would she be able to get away with it again? Especially if the king is doing something that he considers really important, which is namely not looking like an idiot by honoring Mordecai. You know, this is totally out of their hands at this point in the story. Which then begs the question, whose hands is it in? Right? And I think we have to see God at work here. And then, of course, the kind of, you know, crowning irony of the chapter is that Haman assumes that the king wants to honor him, because who else would the king want to honor besides me, right? Who's as good as I am? You almost hear him singing the Gaston song from Beauty and the Beast, you know what I mean? But notice what he asks for. So the king says, what's to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman says to himself, well, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? And so he describes what he wants as what this person, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, should receive, which is to dress up like the king. Take the king's clothes, take the king's horse, take the king's crown, a royal crown, put it on this guy, and march him through the city with one of the noblest princes in the land leading the way and telling everyone, this is what happens when you, or this is what will happen to the one whom the king desires to honor. He wants to dress up like the king. I think that's critical. Yes.
So, another twist of irony, if this had worked out in Haman's favor, and if he had been the person, the king was worried about him already.
Possibly.
This would draw, like, yeah, even more attention, because clearly, Haman wants to be in the first place, and so if the king's already thinking, like, this would have turned out really bad for Haman.
Yeah. And so, I have proposed that the king might be worried about Haman based on that invitation from Esther. That's just a proposal. I can't prove that from the text. But it does fit with something like this, where the king would maybe be a little bit suspicious before, and then even if the king knows that he's not talking about himself, it's like the first thing that Haman wants to talk about is dressing up like the king. That seems a little bit odd. And we're going to see these kind of suspicions come to fruition in the next chapter. But if the king is being suspicious, yeah, this would definitely set off alarm bells. The other thing that's fun about the description that Haman gives about what should happen is he says the man whom the king decides to honor three times in one sentence. It's like he's rolling it around in his mouth. You know, like a fine wine or something. He's like tasting it. It's like, oh yeah, that's awesome. The man whom the king desires to honor. Says it three times. Just, you know, it's just the height of egotism here. The other thing that is less obvious in English is that the language in this verse is really disjointed. Like, he's kind of, you know, cherry picking ideas about a crown and, oh, a horse and, oh, a robe. You know, he's kind of darting around in his mind, grabbing things that he thinks are indicative of high honor and throwing them all into a sentence. And I think it indicates his kind of, you know, fevered and excited state. And he also uses the word royal, I think, seven times. Again, just this emphasis on sort of pretending to be the king. But what I want us to see is that if God is active nowhere else in the book of Esther, I think he is, but if he's not active anywhere else, he's definitely active in this scene. Mordecai's fate and the Jews' fate hangs in the balance. Esther and Mordecai are not involved. We have a codependent monarch and an egotistical grand vizier with very different ideas about what to do to Mordecai. But the king has a bad habit of believing everything that Haman says, and we've seen that already in the story. So the only reason that this turns out well is on one, well, two reasons. One is Haman's, the king gets to talk first, that's sort of his right, and Haman's natural egotism stomps on the accelerator on the conversation, and they rush right past, wait, who are we talking about, straight to what should be done for this person. And so Haman's rapturous description of dressing up like the king is ironic because he's actually describing what's about to happen to Mordecai. What's maybe the most ironic thing is that he insists in the description that it be one of the king's most noble princes who leads Mordecai around. Who's the most noble prince or officer in the whole kingdom? He is the grand vizier. There's nobody more qualified than he is to administer this honor to Mordecai, including, you'll notice, putting the robe on him. Let them bring a royal robe. For the, it could be like just the servants. I think what he might be saying is this is what the officer is going to do. He's going to be the one who dresses up Mordecai and puts him on the horse and leads him through the square. So this is the next to last of a long series of events in Esther that are easy for us reading it now to view as inevitable, right? Like, well, of course, you know, Haman didn't ask who they were talking about. Of course, you know, he was upset with Mordecai. But the thing is, if God is not active in this story, then all of these things that have happened are just happening by chance. And the chances of everything in the story working out the way it does is astronomically low. And I can demonstrate that by showing you the list of all 20 things that have to happen exactly right in order for the Jews to be saved. Right? And this goes all the way back to chapter 1. Vashti, if she appears, no story. If the king decides, you know what, I'll let her get away with it, no story. If Esther is not rounded up with the other girls, no story. If Haggai doesn't notice in advance Esther, she's not the queen, the Jews get killed. If Esther is not chosen by Ahasuerus, again, she's not the queen, the Jews get killed. Mordecai doesn't overhear a plot and report it. He's not in the chronicle. There's no recourse for the Jews. There's no other document to counter Haman's. And you can go through this entire list like that. But here's the thing. So this list covers the whole book of Esther, from chapter 1 all the way, well, really just through chapter 7, because after that it's mostly procedure. But here's the thing. All of these happen in chapter 6. It's 7 out of the 20 happen in chapter 6. This chapter, almost every verse is an example of God working providentially in the circumstances without having to do a miracle, without having to stop anybody from being eaten by a lion. He works in the circumstances to save his people. If any of these don't happen, the Jews will be destroyed, and even if they are rescued by some other means, as Mordecai says, Haman will still be in power, and he'll probably try again. And the fact that all of these do happen, I think, overwhelmingly argues that this is God at work. Someone who's better at math than I am, if each of these is a coin toss, a 50-50 chance, 20 events, what's the probability they would all happen in a row in exactly the right order? Somebody can do the math. I'd be interested to know that. But anyway, it's pretty astronomical. And I want to draw one quick application from this. It may be a sign that God's providence is at work in our lives or in someone else's if the situation that we are thinking about had happened any other way, a provably good thing, not like I feel better, but like somebody was baptized, right? something like that, provably good thing, would certainly not have happened. If that person hadn't walked into the building with no prior contact on that Sunday morning, which eventually led to their baptism, you see, that I think I would feel pretty confident identifying that as God's providence, because there's no other way that we could see for it to have worked out the way it did. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that there are lots of other variables, there are lots of other things happening in the world that might have changed the course of events later down the road. And so, I do think that is something that we could look for in our lives, things that, if they happened in any other way, would not have resulted in this thing that we know God works to accomplish in the world. But I'll end that point by saying, as Mordecai says, who knows? God works in more ways than we can comprehend, and so we can't know that for sure. But I wonder if maybe that's something that we should be looking for in our lives. Anything else from the first 9 verses that jumps out at you? Yes?
Just thinking of the providence thing, if something had happened where, say, the first few things don't happen, the 1 through 5.
Yeah.
But Mordecai overhears the plot. They figure out that he overheard it and they kill him. Then Haman has no reason to go against the Jews.
Right.
So, I guess I'm just kind of wondering if there could have been ways that maybe this scenario never even comes to pass.
Well, I would. So you can always play the what if game.
Right.
Yeah. But I would just say, if these hadn't happened, Mordecai wouldn't have been in a position to overhear the plot. He gets promoted to the gate as a result of Esther becoming the queen.
That's right.
So, yeah. Like I said, you can play the infinite what if game, which is fun. But yeah, I think in your specific example, I don't think
Mordecai would have been around to have him get upset with him or be triggered by him or whatever it is.
That's entirely possible, right?
But then maybe there are things when this all plays out, it affects God's people in a way than if it hadn't happened at all.
Right.
So,
I think we are intended by the author to see that because Haman is described as an Agagite, that we're intended to think, whether it's literally true or not, we are intended to understand that as an Agagite, he was always going to be going for God's people. He just happened to be triggered by Mordecai. But again, that's a little bit of speculation. But yeah, that's a good question. But that's the issue with providence. There's always another way that something could have happened, right? And it's only when you get, you know, these kinds of odds stacking up that you can kind of go, okay, clearly that was God at work. Yeah, but that's a good observation. Anything else? Okay, let's read the end of this chapter. Someone read verses 10 through 14.
Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai, and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house in mourning, and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wife Men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared.
So this is not a contemporaneous painting. It's from the 18th century. But I like it because this is Haman. And I love how he's having to explain to these two guys, like, what happened to him. Right? They're like, "Dude, what happened? You thought you were the king's favorite and you're leading this guy around?" He's like, "I don't know. I think it's not, you know, I didn't do anything. I just showed up." Anyway, I love the way the artist has painted that moment. A couple of quick notes about the end of the chapter. It's interesting that Zeresh puts together that that there is a greater power at work, because she says if Mordecai's Jewish, then you're in trouble, and he is. So he is. But I don't know how she knows that. I mean, I know how she knows he's Jewish. How does she suddenly remember, suddenly conclude, that if he's Jewish, then, parentheses, God's on his side, and therefore you're going to fall for him? She didn't realize that earlier. Like, I don't know. It's kind of an odd moment.
Yeah, it was her idea about the gallows, right?
Yeah.
That's the strange
thing. Yeah, yeah. Although, I guess I would just say, how many of us have, in one way or another, assumed we can defeat God's purposes, right, in our lives, and then, oh, somebody's said yes. Scott has.
Yeah, well, also, with Zarah, she says, like, if Mordecai, before you, whom you have begun to fall, I think she's kind of realizing Haman's first, bad...
Yeah, it's already started.
Really, she's seeing kind of like the dominoes starting to...
Yep. Yeah,
falling and realizing things are about to take place. Because I'm sure they all know about a bunch of stories from Jewish times where God's providence has acted, and unlike against unlikely odds, the Jews have prevailed. And I'm sure she's probably reading this like maybe this is God working again. And
yeah, so yeah, and so my point then is. How often do we kind of think, oh, I can get by with not doing what God tells me to do, and it's only when it starts to go wrong that we realize, oh no, God actually is in control, right? And so maybe that's something we can take away from her behavior to try to remember earlier, before things go wrong, before we make the decision to fight against God, that He is in control. But then I just love the way this chapter ends. It's like, if this was a television show, this would be the cliffhanger ending. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. They run in and drag him off. You know, it's time for the banquet, and he's right in the middle of another pity party, and they interrupt him, haul him off to the banquet. I think that's funny that Haman doesn't get, from chapter 6 on, Haman doesn't get a moment's peace until the end of his life. Yes.
And I love how accurately Haman's ego comes through the text.
Yeah.
Because after all of this, he went home and told them everything that had happened to him.
Right.
You know?
Right.
This is Mordecai's moment.
Yeah.
And all Haman takes from it is, this terrible thing has happened to me.
Yeah.
So it never stops.
And this picture kind of captures that, because who's your eye drawn to? Not Mordecai. It's drawn to Haman. He's in the brightest clothes. He's in the dead square center of the painting. You know what I mean? Like, this guy knew what he was doing when he painted this picture. It's pretty masterful. Okay, let's read. Someone read 7:1-6, and I want us to consider this question: why did Esther tell the king, "If we'd only been sold as slaves, I would have remained silent"? Someone read verses 1-6.
So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet, and as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, "Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even if they have to keep him, it will be granted." Then Queen Esther answered, "I have a favor with you, Your Majesty. If it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I am a people that have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and murdered. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, we kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." Then King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he, the man who is there to do such a thing?" Esther said, "His adversary is an enemy, the vile Haman." Then the king was terrified before the king.
Okay, so Esther's, finally making a request. She's pleading for her life and for the life of her people. But she says, "Now, if we'd only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." Why do you think she says that? Seems like she's sort of undercutting her own argument a little bit. "So you've got to save us. Slavery's okay."
Kind of emphasizes how much worse the actual circumstances are.
That's true. It does.
I think it shows her deference to him, saying, mm-hmm. Wouldn't have come to bother you, and even in this bad scenario, wouldn't have been worth it. But I had to, I'd be killed anyway, almost.
Right. I think that's a really important part of what's going on. Julia, you have your hand up.
I think she's arguing, kind of what she was saying, she's presenting the situation in such a way that King Xerxes helps them by by granting her request, he'll be revered as a hero.
Right.
And that'll serve to his ego and like make him seem more
competent. Yeah. So this is the, I mean, Esther has already kind of disobeyed the king's law about coming into his presence and all of that. But I mean, this is the, I think this is the real moment in the story that we are intended to compare with Vashti's action back in chapter 1. So it could be that this is just a typical supplication from an inferior to a superior. In other words, she kind of means it, but it's really just a polite thing to say, right? It could be that. And it does have the courtly language in it, which, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, the other thing about Haman's request about the dressing up like the king is that the language there is apparently the kind of tone and syntax you would use addressing an equal, a person of equal rank. Right, so it's like he's talking to the king like they're best friends. But when Esther makes her request, she does it in very deferential language. And I think we're intended to see that contrast. But the other contrast between Esther, or with this deferential language, is between Esther and Vashti. Vashti also didn't wanted to do something different than what the king had said, and she just refuses point blank and doesn't fear. Right? Esther is very deferential. She's very respectful of the king. I think we're intended to contrast this behavior with Vashti's. Esther is gaining the power she needs to fix the problem, but she's doing it without subverting the king's authority and headship, even though he's pretty unworthy of the honor that she gives him. There's one other thing that might be going on here, possibly. She basically says, you know, if the Jews were sold into slavery, that would be okay. Has that ever happened before? Yeah, so maybe Esther is showing a little bit of faith here and saying, you know what, just make us slaves, because God, I know God can fix that. He's fixed that in the past. Possible. Don't really know for sure what she's thinking. Yes?
And all of this, if we're taking into account our hypotheticals about who Ahasuerus is, she's setting this up as, this is our darkest hour, and it's only you who can save us.
Right.
And oh, by the way, the person you're saving us from is Haman. You know, so all of those threads that we've seen, that he wants to be seen a hero, isn't really, kind of suspicious as Haman. You know, all of this comes together
Yep. In
you are the only person who can save us, which again, absolutely plays to his ego. And
yep.
So she's really smart in the way.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
She's also, it may be a bit of a stretch, but like, you're getting no economic benefit out of this either.
That's true, yeah.
You're about to lose a whole bunch of people in your kingdom, and
yep.
They're just going to be gone.
Yep. So a couple of quick things on chapter 7. The king leaves to try to cool off, maybe, verse 7. He arose in his anger from drinking wine. So this is like perfect decision-making mood for the king, right? He's mad and he's drunk. Time to make a decision. But he walks off, and again, I think that's providential, that he leaves and Haman suddenly feels a little bit less constrained by some of the social mores that would have dictated his behavior. So he falls onto Esther's couch to beg for his life, which is a natural thing to do in one sense, but it's also very dangerous, very inappropriate socially to do that. This kind of contact between unmarried people in public is highly inappropriate, and when one of them is the queen, it's even more appropriate to the level almost of treason. Sorry. So the king returns at exactly the right moment, providentially, and finds Haman in this compromising position. And, you know, if the king is suspicious of a plot being developed, suddenly Haman looking like he's trying to seduce or molest his wife, would just be total confirmation of everything that he had been concerned about, right? Sleeping with the king's wife was a common way to sort of bolster your own claim to the throne. That's what Absalom does in 2 Samuel 16 at Ahithophel's advice. And it would also explain why he interprets Haman begging for his life as Haman either begging Esther to sleep with him or, more improbably, actually assaulting her. It seems unlikely that Haman would actually be doing that, but the king describes it that way, and one potential reason is that if Haman is assaulting the queen, then he can be killed instantly for that. If he's just sort of making laws that the king doesn't like, then the king has to sort of expose that and embarrass himself by showing that he's, you know, promoted this evil and incompetent person to the grand vizier position. But the fact that he can describe it as assaulting his wife means he can just kill Haman instantly. And so this is good for the king. Saves face, you know, works out well for him. And he doesn't have to look inept in the process. So Haman's face is covered. That's kind of a cultural sign of shame, but also a sign that he's about to die. I love the way all these chapters end, actually. But this chapter ends with the eunuch kind of sidles up to the king, and without being addressed first, which is technically a violation of custom, says, "Look, there's Haman's gallows. We should hang him on those," you know. And the king says, "Yeah, good. Sounds good to me. Already ready. Let's use it." A couple of things about that. Apparently this is visible from the garden. Maybe that's why it was so tall. Haman wanted to be able to see it from work. Another thing is, I've noticed that the eunuch rushes to give unsolicited advice to the king, and maybe that's because he doesn't like Haman very much. We've seen hints of that earlier in the story, and maybe that's what motivates him here. Most of your texts will talk about hanging and gallows. In reality, it's a stake, and he's being impaled. That's actually what's going on. This is a drawing or a relief of these are actually Judeans on these stakes here. But that's what we're actually talking about. So it's not a gallows that's 50 cubits high or whatever. It's a stake that high on the top of which Mordecai was intended to be impaled, and now Haman's actually impaled. Anyway. Good way to end the class, right? But I hope you take away from this list of instances of providence in Esther 6 and how crucial this chapter is to the book, and also maybe to our understanding of God's providence in general. Okay, thank you for your attention. Lesson 7 for Wednesday.